Now the thing is like this, that he goes after, now he goes after the second image, right? But since the man has spent his time directing his energy into this area, now think like this, once he was frustrated in the first step, you see, he was frustrated because his energy was involved to a great degree in this emotion, right? Now the thing is, the very involvement in this emotion directs more channels, more energy into that emotion, right? Now with more energy channeling that emotion, the demand for the real thing is even greater than it was before, because there's more energy directed to the emotion. The emotion wants the real thing. So therefore the demand is now even more for the real thing than it was in the first instance, because there's more energy channeled into the area. Now, one second. Now what happens is, with more energy channeled into the area and a greater demand for the real thing, you see, and he sees the image set up again, he runs after the next one, he's running after it with greater gusto. And since it's not going to be satisfied with any substitutes, he's going to reach a greater state of frustration when he gets to the second point. You see? And so on, ad infinitum. That's the way it'll work. You see? Until we'll be obsessed. Well, at the end you find what happens is, if you want to take a real prototype, there are many things that can stop a person along the way. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are things, we're just following a logical sequence of following an instinct. There are many things that can happen along the way that could stop this. I mean, it could stop this process. As we said before, life works on plays on the strings of the soul. You know what I mean? So certain things could happen. A person could have a tragedy or something, and a personal tragedy in which he gets, in which his energy is diverted to something else, and he can get out of this thing. I'm just following the logical pattern. If nothing interferes, given nothing interfering. What? Yeah, right. Exactly. That's really what Plato described in the end, towards the end of the Republic, when he describes the state of mind of the tyrant. You see? The state of mind of the tyrant. His unrest, his unhappiness isn't the word, I mean, his misery, the misery of the tyrant. You see? And everything around them just becomes one thing, a source for that fantasy satisfaction and frustration. And it mainly is frustration. That's why when you read the lives of the Rishi Olam, you'll find that that's the type of lives that they led. I mean, Beria and Stalin. And Stalin, read about his life. You see the type of, people think a maniac. Not a maniac. Wasn't a maniac. No maniac can run a country. He's not a maniac. He's a person who has followed this line of instinctual involvement. And he's reached that point. That's the point. He can't go back. He can never go back, I want you to know. There's no way he can go back to the first step. Because the instinct now is so powerful, and it's attaching itself even greater to the fantasy. The only thing he can do is at that point, is conquer the world. That in his mind, at that point, you see, in his mind, if he'd conquer the world, he'd be totally satisfied. Alexander. Yeah, that's right. Alexander the Great. That's of the Russia is the worst thing for him. It's the worst thing for him. I mean, even if you take Hitler, Yimach Shemai. Even if you take Hitler, Yimach Shemai, when he first started off in a slow way, the world didn't even recognize him. He's such a crazy... Now everybody's a big chacham. They say the man was an insane monster, you know? But the truth of the matter is that at that time, if you go back in history, he didn't appear such a crazy monster. And in all probability, he wasn't that great of a monster when he first started. You see? In all probability, it's possible. But the insatiable desire, the situation, lends itself to an exacerbation of the illness. You see? Until the person reaches a state where he's completely almost insane. I mean, not really insane. Insanity is something else. Almost insane. Almost insane in the sense that reality, every bit of reality, only serves one function, and that is to satisfy this compulsive, insatiable desire. See? Yeah. The frustration, the more powerful the imagination that if you have that given situation, you're going to avoid it. Because now, the desire to avoid the frustration is even greater. You see? And the desire, because you're being frustrated in the first step, right? And the frustration is a painful thing. So you desire to avoid it, you have even greater motivation to avoid it. So the greater motivation to avoid it will attach itself even, will make the attachment to the next object even stronger. See? That's right. Exactly. The mistake the individual makes is one thing. Is the fact that the substituting is the mistake. The substitution is the mistake. See, that's the mistake. The substitution. The substitution is the mistake, and why does the substitution work? Because the desire is so great and must be satisfied that it cannot accept the idea that it can't. You see? That's why it will take the substitute and raise it to the level of the real thing. Just like a person who's in the desert cannot tolerate the idea that there's no water, he begins to see in front of his eyes a beautiful brook, stream running with water. What is that phenomenon? Everybody knows, a phenomenon of a mirage. But the phenomenon of the mirage is based upon the fact that the person can't tolerate the frustration of the water. So not only will it take a substitute, he'll invent a substitute in his mind. He has to invent it. Then when he gets to that mirage and he tries to drink, he's twice as thirsty. Because now he's more frustrated. Now he thought he's gonna have water, and he doesn't have it. You see? So now he has to set up a better mirage. That really is what happens with the psyche. It's a perfect example of what happens with the psyche. That's the way the mind works. You see? The Russia can never get out of it. That's why the Pusuk says, Varshoyim Kayam Nigrash. It means that the Russia, the wicked person, is turbulent like the ocean. Has a turbulent life. Because he's always immense pain. The only thing is that why do people really envy the Russia? They envy the Russia because of one mistake. Because they look at what he has and they think, in terms of their level, this is exactly what I want. And you want to know something? That's the only thing that keeps the Russia going. Because part of the thing is that he sees that everybody wants this. I must be a very fortunate individual. You see? If it wasn't for that, he'd have to face his frustration. You see? People keep him going. Because people have a certain... People somehow, like the Rambam writes in the Gemara many times. He says, like he says in the beginning, he says, when the road is in his introduction, he says, when the road is narrow and I have no real course, he says, no other way to travel, he says, I would rather satisfy the one intelligent man than the 10,000 fools. You know? He says, the purpose of the book is really to improve everybody. But when there's no way, he says, I don't care. Or when the Rambam says, the truth, no matter how few times it's uttered, is nevertheless true. And a falsity, no matter how many times or how many people say it, is always false. Why does the Rambam say that? It seems like a simple thing, right? Of course, if something's false, it depends on how many people say it. The answer is because people, there's an emotion that doesn't believe that. There's an emotion that maintains that if everybody says something, that's reality. You see? That if everybody says, why do the Christians have to destroy the Jew? Because they felt all the Jews, there's a group of Jews that are denying their religion. The fact that they deny it presents a certain reality which they can't tolerate, so they have to destroy the Jew through that. They're going to change their reality. You see? So people really have a certain emotion, a certain feeling, which you have to understand what the source is, but it definitely exists, that when large numbers of people say things, that this becomes reality. You see? So the Russia is assuaged somewhat by the large multitudes of people, you see, large multitudes of people consider him very fortunate. You see? It serves to keep him in the... it's a certain amount of satisfaction. There is a certain amount of frustration. But the frustration, of course, he can't... the inherent frustration, but a certain amount of satisfaction there is, no question about it. That's what keeps him in luck. So really, the other people are responsible for him, and they're in a state of frustration because of their own commencing illness. See, he's in the more advanced state. You follow? That's why Chazal, in the time of Chazal, the Gemara says Rabbi Akiva was a person that changed his life. First, he was a shepherd, and he had nothing to do with learning Torah, you know, as you know. And then later, he became a great Talmud Chacham, right? So Akiva said, he one time said, he says, when I was in Am Haaretz, he says, when I was an ignoramus. He says, I used to say to myself, give me a Talmud Chacham and I'll bite him like a donkey. You see? So the Tosfos says, I think Tosfos says, it means I'll break a donkey when he bites, he breaks the bone. He doesn't just take a bite of flesh. It means he had tremendous envy. And in the time of Chazal, the Amei Haaretz had a tremendous envy for the Talmidei Chachamim. You see? Because the Talmidei Chachamim presented a different value system and they didn't support, they failed to support the fantasy of the Russia. Of the Amharic. So therefore, you see, he was in a state of total frustration that there is no need for this, for these objects. See, so this is something which causes the Amharics to be very doubly frustrated. See, that's the situation. That's right. The Tzitzis and Vera always said last time. Yeah. But the Pirkei Avos, that the Harchek Mishochin Ra, because the fact is that when people utter, large numbers of people utter or believe or live by certain principles, there's a tendency for an individual to attach an element of reality to that, just because they're large numbers. See, large numbers. And the truth of the matter is that's also the same sin existed between the Christians against the Jews. Why? Because the Jews never really made a big deal out of Christianity, or trying to disprove it in any way. You see, there was, if the Jews would have fought against the Christians and brought them to task, you know, let's have debates. The Jews never asked for debates. Christians wanted debates. The most disturbing feature of the Jew for the Christians was the fact that they simply were not concerned about it. There was no recognition of the this. That was the most stern feature. That's why they were so inflamed. You see? The person can survive. There's some type of value. There's no recognition means that these people represent, in other words, to these people, there is no reality of the Christian belief. There's no need to discuss it even. There's no reality. That idea was too much to take. And it's an interesting thing. But the Gemara says in Pesachim that the hatred of an Amoritz for a Talmud Chacham is greater than the hatred of a Goy for a Jew. It's an amazing thing. You know? It's an amazing thing. Why is that so? It's so because of the fact that there's a greater closeness between an individual Amoritz and the Talmud Chacham, you see, than the Christians. It's a societal thing. A national basis. They don't really know, you know, what the Jew is. But an Amoritz within the society, his interaction and interrelation with the Talmud Chacham is much, much greater. So therefore, the hatred is even greater. That's the sentence. Based upon the idea that reality is determined by what people think. And everybody is subject to that phenomena, psychological phenomena. That's why the Pirkei Avos gives the advice of Harchek Mishochin Ra.
Isn't that a problem like that?
Somebody asked, what's the relationship between tefillah and tshuva? Tefillah is where a person withdraws from the psychological reality and he contemplates the objective reality. So he breaks the psychological reality. Once he breaks from the psychological, that's the break. Once he breaks from the psychological reality, then he's able to reflect upon his own internal reality to see if it's in line. If it's in line, how much it's in line with reality and how much it's not. It's out of line. That's the importance of tefillah. That's important to do. Tefillah and tshuva have to go together. There's no such thing as, that's why Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is tefillah and tshuva. Tefillah and tshuva must go together. Has to be. They go hand in hand. Impossible to have one without the other. It's impossible to have one without the other.
What?
The Torah is really not enough. Because Chazal say that a person can study Torah for different, devious reasons. For different purposes. Like a person can study Torah, the Gemara says lakanter, in order to make himself great. I mean, there's an ego satisfaction in knowledge. That's why Yadis didn't conceive. See, some people have a very big when it comes to Talmud Torah. Comes to tefillah, you know, what do you need this for? It's hard to daven. Tshuva, that's not important. Talmud Torah, everybody's attracted to it. Why? I'll tell you why they're attracted to it. Because they're not really attracted to perfection. And they're not really convinced about the most basic premise of Yadis, which is which is that a person's soul has to have a certain environment and a certain way of functioning in order to achieve happiness. They're not convinced about that at all. But Talmud, knowledge is a big thing. Of course, everybody has to recognize knowledge. Knowledge has an ego recognition. I mean, nobody praises a fool, right? So one second. So therefore, people are naturally attracted first to Talmud Torah, and they conceive of tefillah and tshuva as a waste of time, because they're just in line with their egoistic motivations. They really haven't changed. When a person gets the true goal, which is perfection, when that's really his goal, then he will recognize tefillah and tshuva and Talmud Torah. It's all part of a process. You see, it's all part of a process. But there's no differentiation. Everything is there. The Torah, you had to set out a system in which a person can achieve perfection. All those elements are important. You know what I mean? Are equally important. Equally important. Without Talmud Torah, there's tefillah and tshuva is nothing, because without knowledge, what is the perfection? Perfection has to involve knowledge. See, but knowledge can be used just for egoistic purposes. In that case, the person doesn't really partake of any perfection. Doesn't partake of any perfection. Discuss the point of why in lo lishma. Why is it that if a person is lo lishma, kadeshi heinik rav, which is egoistic, so then we say that it's good. You should do it for that purpose, because eventually you might see the lishma. But lakanter, if a person wants to destroy somebody else, so then we say that that's worthless. The person should not do that. As a matter of fact, he's better off that he would not exist, the Gemara says. So somebody asked the question, what's the difference? We one time discussed this before. The basic answer was that when the Gemara says that Kadesh Yehei Nikra Rav Lashma, it means that the Rav, the concept of Rav, which is a person of importance, can coexist with an enjoyment of learning. They're not tied to the Sasser. Like if you show a little kid, you show him a guddle, so he'll be filled with awe, inspired, and he'll strive to become like that individual. And the enjoyment of the Chachma is not excluded by his striving to become the guddle. But if a person's motivation is to destroy somebody else, that means that he has a single unilateral motivation to destroy somebody, then he's just using this as a means for destruction, then there's no free energy left to appreciate the Chachma. Of course, it's possible in a situation of Kadei Shehei Nikarav also. Depends on the degree. That a person could just want the cover, he doesn't want anything else, everything else is worthless, and it's just like Lakanta, there's no difference. But the Gemara says that generally speaking, in a person's mind, psychologically, the two blend, the value system and an identification with an individual who embodies that value system. Because he doesn't know the value per se yet, so he identifies with the individual who embodies that system. So the two are not tied to the sasri, you see? They're not tied to the sasri. So, mitoch shlo lishma is bolishma. Right now, it can only be motivated by the individual, you see? Later, he'll come to recognize that the activity itself has value. But lakanter is a means that he's just using this as a means. He wants his emotions to destroy somebody. That's his emotion. So he's just using this as a destructive thing, and there's no shaykhus, and the emotion of destruction is totally exclusive of any value in the thought itself. So therefore, it's worthless. Brought a good example about the... We mentioned that a person, the nyadas, a person striving should be totally for perfection. And even Talmud Torah itself doesn't necessarily mean, because a person is a great great scholar, that he has perfection. There's no guarantee. There's no guarantee. However, definitely, without Talmud Torah, there is no perfection. There's no question about that. But it's possible for a person to use Talmud Torah for different purposes, in which case he isn't perfected. At any rate, there are many characters in Tanakh, you find. Tanakh and Chazal also. The Chazal recognized that they were very great in terms of Talmud Torah, but yet they weren't great in terms of perfection. Like we mentioned many times, start with Mephibosheth and David HaMelech. Mephibosheth was a Mevayesh Pnei David Ba'alocha. We'll soon come across, the Rambam mentions another individual from Tanakh. Interesting person also. On a similar type of thing. Daegademi. I will get to that soon. But at any rate, the emphasis of Chazal really is that Torah is a means of perfection. And it must be used as such. And somebody cited a good example where a person comes into Davin with a sefer. You know, a lot of times you find people come to Davin with a sefer, and during Chazaras HaShatz, They read through where they learn. Suddenly they become overpowered by a desire to learn. See? So he said that what is that really? Basically the person has no relationship to perfection. So really tefillah has no part in his life. Has no part, but he can't break the halacha. I mean, have to daven. Because that would disturb his ego more than anything else. But Talmud Torah has a certain ego value. Talmud Torah has a certain value to the individual in terms of his instinctual frame. It fits very well to his instinctual frame. And Chachma, yeah, it's something that a person should have. It's something that gives a person pride. So therefore, Talmud Torah understands. But Tefillah has doesn't fall in line with his instinctual drives. So therefore, he is overpowered by the desire to learn B'Shas Tefillah. See? Well, I mentioned that certainly is not the individual who recognizes that the purpose, or who believes that the only way that a person can have the best existence is through perfection of the soul. Okay. Well, by saying that the person, the most important basic principle that a person must have in order to perfect himself is to realize that the soul has a structure, so to speak, and that cannot be satisfied simply. But the reason why a person fails to recognize this is because of the situation, particular situation, that the instincts overpower, are related to the mind in a way that they can overpower the intellect. The person can do the most irrational thing, and he can be convinced that what he's doing is correct. So even though he sees it countless times in front of him, He still is convinced. The only way, that's why we mentioned that the only way that a person can remove this conviction is through careful reflection, and at a time when he's not directly involved in the physical, but where he's in a state of withdrawal. You see? Okay. That is the battleground of the Bechira. That particular point. See, where an individual, where the emotions convince an individual that something is a certain way, and that he will achieve happiness through this means, through satisfying his fantasies. The power is an overpowering conviction that the fantasies carry, and then that's on the one hand. On the other hand, there is the mind that can see rationally that it will not be so. He's caught between two things. The powerful emotions and the conviction that results from them, and the conviction that results from the quiet side of his nature that perceives reality and that tells him very quietly that just a minute, didn't seem to work last time. Where are you running this time? And presents logical arguments to him that this is not going to be his salvation. You know what I mean? That's basically the battleground of the Bechira, I would say. That's the battleground of the Bechira. As Aramam learns Pshat, Valtesyayish min aperonios. Valtesyayish min aperonios. So Rashi's Pshat we learned already. Aramam learns... We left that problem before. Yeah, the Rambam was like this. The Rambam says, "Valtesiyash man aperonios" means that kishetechta otira chote. If you sin or if you see somebody sin, lo tiftach v'somar shehashem yisbarach lo yanishu ela b'olam abo. You shouldn't say that God will only punish him in the next world. V'lo sishayish meinokem mimenu mehera alachetahu. And you shouldn't give up the idea that God will take immediate revenge from this individual because of this sin. That's what the Rambam says. All right. What's so terrible? So we ask, what's so terrible if a person thinks that it'll take away his own life? On the contrary, they say, everybody says that an onish. In the next world is worse than any onish in this world. Really? I mean, the Yisuri Gehenim are depicted by many as being much more painful than the Yisur Elamazeh. So what's so terrible if a person thinks that this Russia is going to get an onus in the next world? Be even worse. Be even worse. Should be even happier. The Pach edition is a little bit better. Rams like this. The Amar Sheimcha Tosa or Isa Chote. If you sinned or you saw somebody else sin, I'll titfos. For Seimash, Hashem Yanish, Balam Abobel Vad. Right. Okay? Alright, Al Tasyashman. What does the Rambam mean? What does the Rambam mean? The Rambam says is really what we said last week. That's what the Rambam says. That a person, if a person thinks that God is going to repay the Russia, he's going to exact payment from the Russia in the next world, this person's philosophy is basically that the Russia is having good in this world. See? He really desires what the Russia has, but he holds himself back because he doesn't want to get an onesh. It's a good thing to have it, but it would be nice if he could have it without receiving an onesh. Since that's impossible, a wise person will decide to forego this temporary pleasure in Olam Hazeh in favor of a greater pleasure in Olam Haba, which he assumes is somehow or other of a similar nature, because that's basically what he wants.
It'd be the physical.
But, yeah. But regardless, you see, and the same thing with an onesh. Same thing with an onesh. Person says that this chait is really good, enjoyable, but it's not worth the penalty, in other words. Okay. Yeah. Like this, the difference between Kapach's edition and between the edition that we have is, according to the edition that we have, it says, it would seem, Ela velotis yaish mehi nokem mimenu mehera lachetaho. You see, velotis yaish mehi nokem mimenu mehera lachetaho implies that God will take revenge from this individual in Olam Hazeh. But the way Kapach has it is, Ela velotis yaish mehi apuranos ato b'olam hazeh, alos achet. Not a matter of God doing it, but it's a matter of the thing itself. The thing itself will result in some harmful situation for him. Do you follow? If that's the case, if Kapach's edition is right, what the Rambam is telling us is that if a person only thinks in terms of a schar v'onesh as a substitute situation. In other words, you substitute the thing that you want here for a better thing, and then you avoid the onesh. You avoid an onesh in the next world, even though you have some suffering in this world. See, substitute type of situation. If that's the case, what the Rambam is saying is precisely what we said. That al tesiyash me'at peronos means that you shouldn't think in terms of God's compensation. So you should think in terms of the thing itself. Altasyashma Puranas means that you shouldn't think that a person will not receive an onus for what he does in this world, because everything that he does that is evil inherently carries with it something harmful. In which case his soul will be harmed in reality here. That's the point. Yeah. In Olam Hazeh, what the Rambam is saying is, if I'm worried about Olam Hazeh, it means the reality of the system that God put us in. God put us in a certain situation. The soul's in a certain situation. Now, if you don't live according to the needs of the soul, so you're going to suffer. That has nothing to do with God's particular onesh. See? It has to do with the situation, the very nature of the soul. So what the Rambam is saying is, Al Tasyash Min HaPeronos, don't think only in terms of what God does as an extraneous device, but rather you should think in terms of the natural results of chait. So therefore, don't ever think, don't ever think that a Russia is getting away with anything. If you see a Russia getting away, momentarily he seems happy, you have to realize that that's impossible, because according to the laws of the soul, it's an impossibility. He has to come to harm. So al tesiyash me'aparonos means not to think in terms that a person shouldn't think in terms of compensation, compensative type of reward, but a reward from the nature of one's actions. And that the man who is following who is following an evil way of life has to come to grief. There is no other possibility because of the nature and the structure of the human soul, which wasn't devised for that type of activity. You see, that's what the Rambam is emphasizing. Schar v'onish, what's the difference between olam? Somebody asked if it's schar v'onish, so what's the difference between olam haza and olam haba? What's the answer? In terms of the next world, is a mystical type of life. See? The intellect isn't really convinced that evil is really bad in such a situation. See? The intellect, the mind is not convinced. On the contrary, the mind can go along very well with the idea that the evil is really good. They're the greatest good. We have to keep away from it. See? But the only way that the mind is engaged in the realization of ethics is altis yash min haparanos, with the recognition of the fact that evil is something which is harmful to an individual based upon the very structure of his nature. See, so that's the difference. One is an essential thing. It means according to the way his nature is, that's the harm will result. That's an intellectual perception. That's something which the mind perceives and recognizes. That's a different type of a thing than a person who just has a mystical fear of punishment. That individual really, his mind is not really convinced that evil is a bad thing for him. You understand? It's just that he's afraid of something worse. But essentially, he hasn't really risen much above the level of other people who really practice evil. The only thing is that he foregoes one type of extraneous benefit for another kind of one type of benefit, another type of extraneous benefit. Child listens to his father, is afraid his father's going to smack him, hurt him. So therefore, he eats up because he's afraid his father is going to hit him. So that's really, he has really no concept of the benefit of what he's doing. Whereas an individual who knows that he has to eat properly in order to maintain his physical body, his mind recognizes what the benefit is and what he's doing. The child's mind doesn't recognize what the benefit of what it is and what he's doing. He only is avoiding a different type of extraneous pain, but he doesn't really recognize the benefit of what he's doing. The way Kapach says, you can explain the way we said. It has to do with the most important principle in human ethics, which is the recognition of the fact that the soul has a certain structure and you must live accordingly if the person is going to live a good life. But if you're going to say the way the translation we have in front of us, the Ibn Tibbon translation, so it says, "May he not came, lesishayish, may he not came, mimenu meheira lachetahu." That God will definitely, you shouldn't give up hope from the fact that God will take revenge on that individual in this world. Okay. If that's the case, if you learn that pshat, so then what would the difference, what's the difference between, what would the difference be really? Well, we'd say like this. The other way is a question of the difference of the Shema and the person that's Oved Me'ava and Oved Me'ira. That's the famous difference, the way we learned in Kapach. But if you learn the way Shmuel ibn Tibbon has it, that it means that you shouldn't think that God will not take revenge immediately in this world, then it would seem to say something else. That if a person, even if a person is worried about Onesh, a person is guided by Yiras HaOnesh, he is better off to be guided by Yiras HaOnesh in this world than Yiras HaOnesh in the next world. You see? And you find really the Torah does work with Yiras HaOnesh, because the Torah was written for everybody. Many psukim in the Torah, you see, that deal with Yiras HaOnesh, because the large mass of people really can only relate to such a situation. So of course, the way the Rambam explains is the Rambam says that that's not really the ultimate tragedy, but that's in truth. But the fact is, the way the Torah depicts it, the Torah works with Yiras HaOnesh. Yiras HaOnesh in this world, however, the Torah does not work with Yiras HaOnesh in the next world. Why? Because what it's saying is, it's the similar type of thing, that if the mind is involved, if it has a basis in reality, then it can affect an individual to a greater degree. Even though you'll give all kinds of crazy descriptions of of onish in the next world, and it's only if a person thinks about it, only, it only has a momentary effect. But the reality principle of man causes a person to be affected essentially by what he sees in front of him. So therefore, there's a different shot then. That it means if a person is involved, his life is motivated by yiras ha'onesh, it is better that he should be motivated by a yiras ha'onesh, a fear of punishment in this world, which is reality-based. At least it has a reality base, rather than a yiras ha'onesh in the next world. That if you're going to say his yiras ha'onesh is in this world, so then certain things that occur are liable to misguide him. At least if he thinks about the next world, so he'll see a person suffering, that he thinks that, you know, that's a tzaddik, and he thinks it's unfit for the person to suffer, so he'll say that, well, he'll get paid back in the next world. But if he's going to think only in terms of this world, so it's liable to lead him to a false conclusion.
Yeah.
It doesn't say you should give up the concept of Olam Haba. It just says, Altis Yaish. You shouldn't think that he will avoid punishment in this world. That's all it says. It doesn't say you should give up your concept of Olam Haba. That doesn't say. It's true. Then an individual on that level would have problems. That means he should not think only in terms of Olam Haba. He should think in terms of this world as well. That's what it means. Pshat is superior, because the first pshat is really addressing himself to the person as chacham, or directing him to chachma. Second pshat is speaking to an individual who is really on a fairly low level of understanding.
So how's
right.
He ever going
to
change?
But that's what it's trying to do, is it changes him from the... There's two types of Eved Meir, according to the second pshat. There's a lower type, where he only thinks about Olam Haba. He's completely in the world of imagination, so it tries to remove him from that step, to get him into the world of reality, you see, via the onesh, first step. But then the higher level is to recognition of the what perfection is. Okay, that's the question. I would say that the first pshat, the kapachs pshat, is more probable. But it's hard to judge, because I don't understand Arabic.
What?
Ibn Tibbon, I mean, Ibn Tibbon, so if it wasn't the Rambam, it was Ibn Tibbon that said it. It's also a pshat. Okay. Let's go further.
Next mission.
Three things have in common. One common thread to this advice that Nitai or Bilai is saying. It can't just be random things from just put together for have no shaykhs one to another. What is the, what's the memra? What's the meaning of the, what's underlying the memra? Thread here, but the idea is like this. You see, what the Mimer is telling us is that a person. Let's take Achik Mishachinra. What does Achik Mishachinra really mean? What does it mean? It means to say if a person isn't Achik Mishachinra, it means he did one thing wrong. What did he do wrong? He failed to recognize the influence that his. The influence that his that an extraneous situation has upon him, which means he has a false evaluation of himself. He feels this won't bother me. What do you mean? Why should this affect me? Right? That's what he feels, and most people do feel that way. That won't bother me. If I live next to a Russian man, I know what I'm doing. He doesn't have a realistic evaluation of his nature. Because since his nature has certain characteristics, one of those characteristics is identification. So he will naturally identify with a shachan ra, with rishayim. But he overestimates his own invulnerability to the situation, or fails to realize his own vulnerability to the situation. So he overestimates his own abilities and powers, and doesn't look at his soul in the true way. He doesn't truly evaluate what the nature, what the structure of his soul is. And that's why he would fall into such a trap, you see? And in the second case, Valdeschabel or Russia, there again, he makes a mistake. Well, if you like the Rambam, it's a continuation, just two different forms. But if you learn like the Rabbeinu Yena, so it came out that it meant that a person overestimates reality because of a certain type of situation that he wants to see take place. His type is for a certain situation, a certain thing to occur, and he doesn't want to see the impossibility of it. So he judges by superficial examination as to what the situation is, right? And he creates a certain type of status quo which doesn't exist, which is just based on fantasy. So in that case, it's a misevaluation of the external world because of his own desire. Right? V'altasyayish min aparanis. How does that fit in? V'altasyayish min aparanis? Min aparanis, for individual situations, a misconception, misevaluation with regard to the inner self, a misevaluation with regard to the external world because of his own desires. But the third one is really the hub upon which everything revolves. The third one is that a person should have a realistic evaluation of schar v'einish in general. See, schar v'einish in general. You understand what I mean? That a person's nature is of a certain form, a certain type, and therefore whatever results is a result, a natural result of his being. You see? The Shashman Aparanis, it comes out that that's basically the way Rabbeinu Yehuda learns the Altas Chavala Russia, right? All right. Kind of the same idea. But basically, those are the three ideas that you have here. One idea is a proper evaluation of a person's inner psyche and a true understanding of his nature so that he doesn't fall prey to an overestimation of himself. That's one. He has to recognize the mechanisms, the psychological mechanism with which he operates. And two, you have to use the same principle in terms of reality and not to distort reality in order that it should be in line with your own wishes. And the third thing is that a person should have a general concept that that an individual's soul has a certain nature, and that schar v'onesh is really nothing more than a natural result of the soul either being in a state of satisfaction or dissatisfaction.
Okay.
Really, individual situations which must be avoided in order that one can achieve the third. The third is really the total level. That's the third. Okay. Question, he asked whether the reason that a person overestimates his invulnerability, is it because of his arrogance, or is it because of the fact that he wants to get drawn in? See? It's possible it could be because he wants to get drawn in, but basically, essentially, it's because of his own arrogance. So the truth of the matter is that really you could see even more clearly how the three points come together. Why? Because the first one deals with the breakdown of the overestimation of the self, which is his own arrogance. That's one area. That's one big area where a lot of psychological energy flows. The other, that's the internal. The other area that it flows to is the external. And when it flows to the external, what it does is changes the situation in the external, overestimates the situation in the external. And then the third thing is that only if a person can overcome the flaws that he has with regard to an evaluation of the self and with regard to the external world, then he's in a position where he could recognize that's the only time he's in a position where he can really recognize how the soul works realistically. You see? As long as he doesn't overcome these first two, he never is in a position to be able to recognize how the soul works realistically. You know what I mean? That's so the third one really is the climax of the first and second. You have to have the first and second first in order to reach the third. The third is where the person has a true evaluation of the nature of the soul, which is only possible if he has not been fooled by the overestimation of the self and the overestimation or overcome by the taivas with regard to the external world. You know what I mean? Those two. Man, there are two desires. The ancient philosophers divided it into two classes: the lovers of honor and the lovers of money. basically two things. They were right, because the one is taivas, external taivas, and one is the internal. That's all there is, really. Besides, love is the wisdom. Why you have to follow this order? Why you can't reverse the order? Why can't you start from the idea that the soul has a certain structure? And then it'll be able to undo the first two. The answer is like this. The answer is because you have to have the energy. You have to have energy. First of all, you have to have the free energy in which to evaluate. Naturally, the energy goes to these two sources. Naturally, without any effort, it goes to these two sources. Now, as long as the energy is tied to those two sources, there's no way that he's going to be able to sit down and reflect upon the nature of the soul. You know what I mean? So in order to do that, he has to withdraw the energy from the two sources. Really, whether there's three things here, the way we learned, that would be according to the Rambam. But according to the others, it'll just be two things. If there's just two, so then you can easily see what the main idea is. One is the internal, and the other is the external. All right? Okay.
What?
Really, how can you really do tshuva? Because the only way to do tshuva is that you have to remove the energy, withdraw the energy that's engaged in reality. And why would you, how are you going to withdraw the energy that you're engaged with reality? I mean, if you don't have a tshuva, you don't realize it's wrong. Is frustration. Frustration is the thing that removes the energy. When a person, that's why the worst thing for a rusher is if he's matzliach. If he's successful, that's the worst thing for him. Because when he's successful, he doubles his investment. See? If he's frustrated and he's unsuccessful, that for him is the best thing, because then the energy is removed from the situation. There's a chance that it could be turned inward, start thinking about it.
Also,
for Onish. Helps also, no question about it. No question about it. And Nasan and Navi caused David HaMelech to do tshuva. You know the mashal over there. Navi bring about the situation of tshuva for David HaMelech. How did he do it? Because really David HaMelech was involved with Bathsheba, so he didn't think twice about it. He already worked out a plan, and he had Uriah Chiti was done away with. Everything was wonderful. See, it says Vatishma Eshisuri. Finally, he did away with Uriah Chiti, and the wife of Uriah Chiti, which was Bathsheba, of course, heard about the death of her husband, so she mourned him. And then it says, and after that, the mourning passed by. Vayishlach David vayasvel beisai vatila liisha vatel lebein. Okay, everything was fine. But it says the next pasuk, vayishlach Hashem es Nasan el David vayovay elov. Nasan came to David. He said, shnei anashim hayu birachas. He gave him the mashal, right? Two people in one city. One was wealthy and one was poor. The wealthy man had a lot of sheep, and the poor man didn't. And then what happened was, so the a little kivsa achas ketana asher kona. It's a vayachai bore with his the money that was his worked for with his blood. Vayechayeho, and he sustained it. Vatigdalimo, and was raised with him the Imbonov Yachtov, like one of his family, a personal attachment. Mipito Sochal, Umikoso Sishte, Vacheko Sishkov, Vatihilo Kevas. Unbelievable, huh? The description. So, yeah, it was like a pet, you know, it was like one of the family. Vayovay Helech Lisha Ashir, Vayachma Lakachas Mitzaina, Umibkarai. So somebody came to the Isha Ashir, a guest, and he didn't want to take from his sheep. Right? Vayikach es kifsa so ish harash, vayasel ish haboilav. So he took the sheep of this poor person, and he prepared it for the guest that came to him. Vayichav David b'ish ma'id.
Yeah.
Vayichav David b'ish ma'id. David got very angry at that man. Vayomer Nasan Chai Hashem ki ben moves Yishai says ice. It's worthy of death. You see? What's the pshat? Vesakifsu Yishalom Abatayim. Yeah. So what is the, what's the pshat? The pshat is it was more than just halacha. See, David HaMelech didn't violate the halacha. Chazal say that. that she wasn't an Eshes Ish, and there was no halachic abrogation over there. But it was an ethical chait. So that's why he gave him that mashal, you see, and that's why he said, Chai Hashem ki ben moves Eshes Hazeh. He's worthy of death. I guess you don't get put to death, because that's halachically you don't get put to death, but ethically such an individual is worthy of death. That's what he said. You see? But how did Dovid HaMelech come to realize that? Nasa Navi he disengaged his own emotions from the situation. Gave him another situation where he wasn't involved. He was able to think about it objectively. Then he says, then after that, once he saw it objectively, his mind was working properly. Says Vayema Nasan al Dovid Atoha Ish, you are this man. So then he goes through the whole thing. Vayema Dovid al Nasan Chatasi Lashem. So then he recognized, total recognition, because he was able to withdraw his energy from the external situation. So Nasan and Nothing knew how to present it. In order to cause him to realize the realization of tshuva. The end of Perek Aleph begins with the beginning of Perek Beis. Beautiful. But the greatness of Dovid HaMelech was one thing. The greatness of Dovid HaMelech was Chatasi Lashem. That was it. Tshuva. He wasn't an individual that we look up to. You see, because of the fact that he wasn't a chote. No, he was a chote. But his greatness was that he was able to do tshuva. That's the greatness. And you're talking about a Melech Yisrael, you're talking about a man as a king over the greatest empire at the time in the world. Because at the time of Dovid HaMelech, the Jewish nation was the greatest empire in the world. So you're talking about such an individual to be able to say, Chatasi Lashem. And Navi came to him and told him something. That's greatness. Yes. Yudah ben Tabai v'Shim ben Shentach kiblu mehem. Yudah ben Tabai Omer al tas atzmucha ka'orche hadayonim. U'kishiyiyu balei dinim omdim lefanecha yiyu beinecha k'rashoyim. U'kishineftarim lefanecha yiyu beinecha k'zakoyim. U'kishikiblu aleim as a din. Okay. What really is most disturbing about this Maimer? The Maimer states as follows, that you shouldn't make yourself ka'orche adayonim, like a lawyer. We'll take the Rambam. Orche adayonim. Rambam says, what is orche adayonim? Heim ha'anoshim anoshim shalom dematainos v'adinen ad shiyu b'kiyim b'nei odim b'dineihem. They prepare the litigants for the trial. See? And they work out the machabrim shailas. They work out questions. They say, when the dayan asks you this, you say this.
What's wrong with that?
They're
trying to get innocent.
And when you're opposing, it says, so and so, it says such and such, kach tia tshuvas, this is what your answer should be. Alright? Kilu heim orchim adin. As if they prepare the din. Right. Ubale adin lefneim. As if, it's sort of like a play, you know, I mean, like, in other words, it's an artificial situation where they set up a situation as if there is really a regular court scene to prepare the individual mentally, psychologically and factually with what he's supposed to, how he's supposed to respond. Okay. From Orche Adayonim, Kilo Orche Adayonim Lefneim, Vizhira Meidamos Lahem. And he warned them against being similar to these people. Ratzaloma Lalamed Echel Mi Bale Adin Taine, Sheto Ilu, Vyomalo Amor Kach, Otachache Shalderach Kach Vakach. He should not teach the Baal Din a Taine that will be helpful to him. They should say this, or you should deny such and such. He says, "Va'afal pi sheyeda bo shehu ha'oshuk." Even though you know that this individual you're preparing really was mistreated, that he's the one that was oshuk means the one that was taken advantage of. V'shechavro toin alav sheker, and the other party, the other litigant, is lying. Lefi ma shehu choshev be'emes.
What's the lashon?
זה אין מותלו שילמדיו תינה שתצילהו ותוילו לכלל. No, you're not allowed to prepare him and teach him a taina that will be helpful to him. Unbelievable Rambam, huh?
That makes sense.
You're allowed to do this. This would seem to be a just thing to do. I know that this party is just. He's a good individual. Somebody else is taking advantage of him. So I'll teach him, prepare him beforehand how to go into court and win the case. What's wrong with it? What? We're doing this. What? So the reason why I can't do it is because you might be mistaken. Let's say I know for sure.
Yeah.
It really is like this. The question is, I mean, the point that I know an individual who's very just and he's good, and somebody else took advantage of him. Let's say I'm sure about that. The Ram doesn't say that. Maybe you're making a mistake. I mean, let's say we assume that the person is quite certain that this other individual is taking advantage of this person. So yeah, filiyada. Is that filiyada? Why? As I know, I'm certain that the other person is taking advantage. The question is, where do I have more allegiance to? Do I have more allegiance to the individual or to the system? Right. So this way, what I'm doing over here is I'm distorting the system. So the halacha is that I have more allegiance. I must have more allegiance to the system than to the individual. Respond truthfully, which means there's no need for preparation. Reminiscent of the old Socratic dilemma. Question of, should he take the hemlock, right, and abide by the law, even though he's innocent? Or should he escape and work around the law?
He made the right decision.
Second the law. Right, yeah, he made the right decision. That's right.
The son of
Sanhedrin. You know what daf it's on? Son of Shimon ben Shetach, they were angry at him, so they trumped up Edom.
Yeah.
Came and said he was Machal Shabbos?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Machal Shabbos. Right. And it's Chayav Misa, and they couldn't get it. The Edom were really brilliant Edom. They couldn't prove them false. So he lost his son. They killed him. After the Pesach, they confessed, but it was too late. Poskivin Shigah Shivin Echaz Amagat. They had to kill him. What is Maimah doing in Pirkei Avos? Especially the last part. Last part is when, for a judge, it says, when the litigants are before you, they should appear to you like wicked people, guilty. And then when they leave you, you should think of them as just, because they accepted the din. What does this have to do with the Pirkei Avos? Says is that you shouldn't, when it comes time to tell the verdict, so you shouldn't say it in front of one. Like, for instance, if you know that they're both, you have two people in front of you, right, two litigants. Now you know that this one is, that the din is in favor of one of them. So you shouldn't go over to that one and tell them privately that the din is in your favor. You must tell it to both of them, in front of both of them. Why is that? Because this, if you tell them privately, it's as if you're telling him something that he enjoys, because you want him to. It's as if, in other words, as if you're on his side. So in other words, you tell him privately, you call him privately, and I want you to know that you won the case. See? So then there is a what you're doing actually is, you're giving the impression that you're on his side. Right? Not merely a problem of what it looks like. It's a problem of the Dayanim themselves being involved in an emotion which is an emotion of favoritism. So even though actually they decided to write a case, but they're being involved in an emotion of favoritism. And that is an isser. It's an isser for the dayan to be involved in any type of feelings of favoritism, or any type of any type of situation where he has personally gives personal recognition to one side over the other, even though it doesn't make any difference in the verdict of the case. But the court cannot be used as a means to establish some personal type of relationship. So even though they decided the case already, but now what you're doing is you're calling him and saying, I want you to know you won the case. Naturally, there's certain feelings of friendship that are established between the two parties. So Dayanim are using the court as a means to establish some type of personal relationship here. That's also not allowed to do that. Rashi gives another chest from Rabbi Yudoi Goyen. Rabbi Yudoi Goyen says that it means if a man comes before you and he tells you that I'm not interested really in your psak, that you should be a bezin for me, but I want to know what exactly happens in a case where somebody where the plaintiff says such and such and the defendant says such and such. You see, this is the case that I have with a friend of mine, so you're not allowed to discuss it with him or to show him anything in the insofar as the din is concerned. Give him any legal advice. That's what Rabbi Yudoi says. What's wrong with that? Imagine Perikof Alef Halacha Yud gives a case, an interesting case. He says, let's say, for instance, you have two litigants right now, and Eid Echad, and Halacha isn't really accepted. So, let's say, for instance, somebody brings an Eid Echad. So the dayan shouldn't say this is inadmissible evidence. On the contrary, he should say this man has just testified against you. Do you realize that? Because maybe the person, will admit. It will be a source of pressure for him, so he'll admit. You see? And he should wait until the defendant says, it's not true what he's saying. I don't accept him. So apparently the Rambam is not allowed to... what's the law according to the Rambam? You're not allowed to intercede in the legal process in order to... You're not allowed to prevent the influence, the natural influence that results from the legal process. That's what he says. In other words, it's a legal process, right? And a legal process exerts a certain influence on the litigants. You're not allowed to intercede so that influence should be removed or changed. The halacha is you're not allowed to relate to one of the two parties. That's the halacha. So the halacha is that the bezin has to relate only to both. The bezin can't relate to one of the two, because to relate to one of the two already is same shot as before. That's right. Is then personally with one of the two parties. That's what it is. Rabbi Yudoi Goyen could be another reason why he can't tell him. Not only because he shouldn't relate to one of the two parties privately, but because, like the Rambam says, that you're not allowed to interfere with the influence of the natural process of law. Oh, so therefore you're not allowed to tell him. Not allowed to tell him that the what the halacha is. You're not supposed to tell him, because if you're going to tell him what the halacha is, so then he'll start trying. He'll have information. He'll start working out a case. You see. So you're not allowed to tell him that. Witness, exactly. Let's say, for instance, yes, well, let's say the other fellow has one witness against me. What happens then? You're not supposed to tell him. You're not supposed to tell him, oh, one witness is nothing. So here's what the Rambam says. That because by doing that, you'll be helping him out. He might have dropped his case if he thought one witness was something. Mitzvah to give people knowledge over here, it's a mitzvah to keep them ignorant. Not allowed to give him the knowledge that he needs. Interesting thing, huh?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, let me ask you a question, though. He comes to you, so you're not allowed to tell him the particular ins and outs. Just tell him, go to court. You can tell him to go to court. Go to Bezin.
I think you have a good case.
You can listen to his case and encourage him to go to Bezin. If you think that he's being mistreated, that he's losing money, whatever, suffering a loss.
So you could tell him, you can encourage him to go to Beth, but you can't teach him the ins and outs. What that means, well, you have a really good good claim to teach the guy, you know, and it's a valid one. Tell him how to handle himself. You shouldn't do it like the Gemara Ksubas is. The Gemara Ksubas, they gave him an Eitzah how to get what he wanted. The Gemara says, so it was a valid Eitzah. But the Gemara says, and he did it, why? Because Mipsach al Tasale. It means it was his relative. So you're not supposed to turn away from your relative. You're supposed to help the relative. So then it says he changed his mind. Why? Because it says, al Tas which means that people will talk against you, and it will appear as if there's favoritism. That's what the Gemara says. You know, it will appear as if there's favoritism. Okay. So over there is a separate thing, a separate matter. In other words, that you shouldn't be, you shouldn't put the court in, it's halacha, you have to protect the integrity of the court. That's the halacha over there. You have to protect the integrity of the court. All right, so there's different possibilities.
How does
the actual judgment, question of distorting the judgment, you see, changing the influential matters in the procedures of the court. That's right. The courtroom proceeding. You're not allowed to change the courtroom proceeding. It's an interesting thing. That's what the Rambam says. Even the courtroom proceeding, you're not allowed to change. All right, but at any rate, over here is just a question of maintaining the integrity of the court. Separate thing. Basic notion in Al Tas Atzmor Karcha Dayanam. Namely, there are. Cannot be any personal influence in the legal situation. Cannot be any personal relationship in a legal situation. That's the underlying that's the underlying idea in the memory. Okay. Of course, what does this have to do with Pirkei Avos? This should be Zalach and Sanhedrin. What does that have to do with Pirkei Avos? Is perfection, individual perfection. So what does this have to do with it? And this is the last part of the memory too. When you see the litigants in front of you, you should consider them all evil. And when they leave, you should consider them all righteous. Why? Why? Because it means, we mentioned already this, that that a person has to many times use artificial psychological mechanisms in order to as a means of functioning. So this is halacha, that when the Baal HaDinim are standing in front of you, you must envision them as Rishayim. Even though they're not wicked, I mean, you have no reason to judge them wicked, but you have to use that mechanism of considering them wicked in order that you will emotionally react in a certain way that is best suited for obtaining justice. You see? So wicked, you're not going to accept the word they say. So that means you'll check, the burden of proof is going to be on each one. You'll check every word they say. Okay? And when they leave, however, what is Kishin Iftarim Bayanecha? What is Kishin Iftarim Bayanecha? So take a look at the Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah says, Kishin Iftarim Mofanecha, when they leave, you should consider them righteous. He says, Zui Midas Achasidis. Acha Sha'ata Yadeya Sha'echa Tarn Shekel, Yeh Bayanecha Lolam Becheskas Shakran. What does it mean? Zui Midas Achasidis. That's right. The first one has to do with justice. First one is halacha and justice. The last part, the Kishin Iftarim Mofanecha, that's as now the trial's over. So there's no problem of justice or injustice. So therefore, what do I care what you think of them? So he says, this is a Midas Chasidus. The Midas Chasidus, that what? Even though you knew the person was a Tain Sheker, but still, you should consider, you should think of him as a righteous person. He did tshuva. That's what he says. Alright? What?
Yeah.
Why should I send the guy to tshuva? Why should I send him to tshuva so quickly? You shouldn't define the person. You don't really know the person's character. So, you have no right to define the person's character based upon this case, because but actually Yeah, I mean, but let's say I say I did get to know him. I did get to know him. He says, "Ukshneftam ofenach yir benach kezakoyim lekeshe kiblu aleihem es adin." What does it mean, lekeshe kiblu aleihem es adin? When they accepted the din Torah. You see. So what does that? What does that mean? That means that since he accepted, since the individual accepted the din, so you should consider the possibility that with his acceptance of the din, he will be machzer b'tshuva. Ordinarily, you don't say, why should I send a person, like we said before, if a person is a tzaddik, or he says a tzaddik, we see a tzaddik with a chait, so you're not supposed to embrace a tzaddik, the chait de balayla al taharach lo acharav b'yayim. If you see a tzaddik with a levera, at night time, the next day, you shouldn't think that he's a rasha. Why? Because since he's a tzaddik, he always reassesses and reevaluates his actions, so he did tshuva. See? But over here, an ordinary person, we don't assume he's a tshuva. But the answer is that what do we have in favor of tshuva? Kabbalah sadeh. Kabbalah Sadin. If you have, since you have, in other words, you only saw him before the Kabbalah Sadin. So all your knowledge of him was before a certain circumstance took place. You have no right to assume that the circumstance that followed your involvement with him didn't render a change in him. See? That's what it means. In other words, if you see an individual acting in a way that's not proper, and then you see a circumstance befalls him, which can influence him. So you have no right to remain with your original assessment of him, because there was something that took place between your assessment and the way he is now. And that is Kabbalah Sadin. So Kabbalah Sadin, the acceptance, since he accepted the Din Torah upon himself, and he's going to act it out, he's going to keep it, this itself is something which can exert an influence on him and cause him to be Ma'azer B'tshuva. So that's why he says that since there was Kishakib Olayim Asadin, once there's Kabbalah Asadin, then you have no right to suspect him anymore. If he doesn't accept the din, of course. But if he accepts the din, then you have no right to say that the way you, what you knew of him before, from what you knew of him before, that he's still a Rasha. That's what it means. Okay. Tendency to cling to first impressions. But if you see a situation that arises which might change this individual, you have no right to remain with your previous assessment. That's the... At any rate, from the whole memra over here, there's only one thing that really has to do with Pirkei Avos. That's the last part of the statement. But essentially, atas aspar karcha deyanim, and kishiyu baladinam amdum lefanecha yu benach kershayim, has to do with justice. So what does it have to do with Pirkei Avos, really? That's the problem. Pirkei Avos is ethics. In other words, ethical perfection. And this has to do with how you handle yourself in a court of law. Ethical procedures in a court of law. I mean, in all the other members over here, it has to do with the idea should be framed in a situation which is an ordinary life situation. This is a situation which is exclusively related to a court of law. Alright. The Edom very much at length. And you should be careful that when you're questioning the Edom, that they shouldn't discover something from the way you're questioning them as to what is the which way is the right, what is the right thing they should say? What would be in their favor? Or disfavor? Right? Of course. You should try to question the Edom as much as you can. Right? What does it mean? Of course. So what's the answer? If we said have a chaker say them, so it would mean you should investigate them until you're satisfied that what they're saying is true. But have you mar balachkar say them means even after you're satisfied that these Edom are telling the truth, you still should throw questions upon them. In other words, have you mar balachkar say them means that your procedure should be such that you should always continue to investigate the Edom and not rely upon your own sense of satisfaction that what they're saying is correct. That's the halacha. I mean, marba, that's what it says, marba lachkar seidim. As much, marba means as much as you can. Give them as many chakiras. The amount of chakiras should not be determined by the way you view the situation, by the way, by your intuition. The amount of chakiras should be determined by the exhaustion of the chakiras. There's no more. There's nothing more to ask them. Okay. All right. Let's say, Perek Alf Mechazes Lach Dalet. This is a Lidra Shaseidim Lach Chokron Ulahar Bois Bishay Lassan. Be careful that the Edom shouldn't learn anything from your questioning as to what will be favorable or unfavorable. Yeah, of course, it's a dumb question. All right, so what is... What's the big Kaddish? You know, it seems that he learns this one. It's one concept here. It's not two different things. Have Mabar Lachkas Edom, have Zobed Rechashem Techem Liul Medulashakar. It's one thing. He says, "Every marble lachka seidim, every zobe derecha lasa islam drish v'chakira harbe pamim v'bazet tegalasot." So it's one idea. What does it mean? It means like this: that the thing is like this: that a dayan is really caught in a difficult situation. Why? Because the dayan, on the one hand, he has to move ahead with investigation; he has to speak. On the other hand, it's very difficult for him to talk. Because whenever he's talking, there's a tremendous danger that he's going to let something slip. So he has to keep a constant vigilance while he's being chokah the Edom. Dayan actually is in a very strained situation. He's caught in a conflict, sort of. On the one hand, he wants to speak. He has to speak. He has to try to investigate. On the other hand, he has to be very cautious as to what exactly, how he formulates and every word he says. So, according to that, what the pshat is like this. The main part of the memory would be the first part, Avimar Balachkar Seidim. What does it mean, Avimar Balachkar Seidim? That even though you really don't want to go on with Chakira Seidim. Why? Because Chakira Seidim is a very difficult process for the dayan. Because it's a very tense and strenuous process. Since he has to constantly be cognizant, be aware, and be concerned with every word he says, that he shouldn't let anything slip by. You see? So he's in a very strained situation. So therefore, a person in such a situation is liable to cut short the Chakiras Bezdin because of the fact that it's so difficult for him to proceed. You see? So what he's telling you is that you shouldn't allow that emotion to interfere with your chakiras. And you should proceed with your chakiras nonetheless, even though it's very difficult for you because of the fact that you constantly have to be checking and pre-checking everything you say, you should proceed with all the chakiris that you shouldn't, because of that, you shouldn't refrain from producing chakiris. Two things. And you shouldn't get caught up with the other one. The person got caught up with the emotion of being chokah the Edom, so he will overlook the other side. It's one thing, it's really one thing. You need both. He has to function in this manner which he's caught in between. He's caught in between. Chakira demands that a person should want to speak up as much as he can. And on the other hand, he has to be cautious every word he says. Alright? This certainly something that has to do with restricted, which is restricted to court of the best. Has really nothing to do with everyday life. So, makes the question even stronger. What does this have to do with Pirkei Avos? More is that since Pirkei Avos is a subject matter of individual perfection, what does it have to do with a courtroom situation? Now, one possibility was presented as follows, that a judge, an individual who's a dayan, finds himself in a totally different psychological situation. You see, we mentioned last time that certain situations in life draw on certain inner characteristics of an individual and affect them in a certain way. so that a, like the Rambam says, that the machla hanushis talks about the egoism. So the Rambam says that a person, that the more fame a person has, the greater the illness, because the situation is such which caters to this type of illness. Now, what was the possibility that was presented was that over here, with a dayan, you're dealing with a different type of human situation, by virtue of the fact that he is a dayan. You're dealing with the individual human perfection, but individual human perfection has to take into consideration a certain situation where you have a different type of a human being. You have the human being, the individual of a dayan. Dayan is a totally different thing. You talk about the pitfalls of a sheikhid or somebody else, right? So apparently you must say that a dayan has something unique. Your dayan is something unique and special about a dayan that doesn't exist in any other situation. Judging another human being is a unique situation. That's what the that's what Pirkei Avos is telling us. And there's a specific pitfall with regard to that situation. Ordinarily, we don't find ourselves in a situation where we judge, where we are the judge of another individual. We may come to certain conclusions, certain opinions about others, but we aren't really the judge. You can't really execute a judgment. Over here, you have a situation in which an individual is sitting in judgment over another human being and really executing judgment. Yeah. Difficulty with a person who is a dayan. A person who is a dayan must seek ultimate objectivity. Right? Now the problem, however, is he is seeking objectivity, but the factors around him are really subjective, influence him in a subjective way. Right? Because he's dealing with people, and the ordinary intercourse with people is an emotional intercourse, subjective intercourse. So therefore, over here, he has to be able to somehow work objectively in a situation where he always works, functions subjectively. Right? In order to arrive at the truth. What? First member. So what is the first member really? How would you interpret the first member in light of the way we're formulating it? That it's a special perfection for a dayan, a person who is a dayan. See, there's two ways in dealing with a situation in which you have to be totally objective, and yet the factors that you're surrounded with are subjective, influence you in a subjective way. So there's two things. The first thing is that you have to remove yourself from the subjective pull of the situation, right? That's the first one. Fast asma karchadianam. Karchadianam implies that there's some type of you have some type of a relationship, personal relationship, with this individual. Okay, the identification or whatever, according to the Rambam, means that according to the Rambam, of course, it means that you shouldn't allow it. It all comes out the same thing, actually. The personal, just different forms of it. You shouldn't allow the personal to be involved or to pull you, to affect you and influence you in any way. But the second thing is something else. What is the second part of the memra? That you must use psychological mechanisms, subjective psychological mechanisms, in order to arrive at an objective truth. So first of all, you must free yourself from the influence of subjective forces, number one. And secondly, you must use subjective devices and mechanisms in order to free yourself from the pull of the right, from the subjective of influence. Right? You counter it. Okay? Because you can't really be, since an individual can't really be totally objective, so you're liable to be influenced by the emotions of the litigants that are in front of you. So you have to, it's a yubay necha kirashayim.
I thought the,
Well, moreover, he really, in order for him to search for the truth fully, so he has a tendency to be lazy. So in order for him to search for the truth, he has to use an artificial psychological mechanism. All right. So basically, there's two rules that Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach said. What do they say? That a person must first of all be careful that he's as free as possible from any type of subjective influence. One, but that's not enough. They said that man by nature could never really be objective. Can't really be objective. Where's objectivity? In a court of law, that's where there's objectivity. That's where you're searching for the ultimate truth. You see? That's why mishpat is such a great thing. Mishpat is the greatest thing. Mishpat is mishpat lekimo. Because mishpat is total objectivity. Now, a human being is really essentially incapable of such objectivity. So the only way he could possibly hope not to reach it, but to approach it, is through using certain psychological mechanisms that will cause him to attempt to reach the truth. See? So that's why he has to consider the Edom as a Rishoyim. I mean the Bali Dinim as Rishoyim, because he can't allow himself to, naturally he cannot function in a just way, in an absolute objective manner. Can't. His nature is such, he has a corrupt nature. Even the greatest Dayan has to be aware of that. That he has a corrupt nature. He can't really function objectively. So the only hope for him to approach any type of objective justice is by implementing certain mechanisms, certain tricks that he must play with in order to be able to hope that he arrives at some type of objective justice. That's what the statement says. That's what the statement says. That's the basic idea of the statement. So you see, really, it's a universal concept. It's true that the place that the concept expresses itself is in a court of law, but it's a universal concept with regard to man's nature. But is this part of his nature, insofar as society is concerned, is only really expresses itself in a court of law, but it has to do with the nature of man inherently. Man cannot really be objectively just. It's impossible. Because of his subjectivity, he's drowning in subjectivity. The only way to extricate himself is by using certain subjective mechanisms, which will counter the forces of the other ones. That's the only way that he can do it. Even the greatest dying. That's the implication of it. There's no way that you can wipe out the subjective identification. So therefore, you will not proceed to question the litigant properly. You see? So the only way you could do it is to have an image in front of your eyes as if this person is a Russia. And imagine he's a Russia. You imagine he's a Russia, now you proceed in a different way. So you have to use your own subjectivity as a means to arrive at the truth. That's the only way we can do it, because that's the way we are. That's due to our nature. Exactly. Yeah, see? That was a top salesman. Salesmen use all these... what was the name of the book? Hidden Persuaders, right? Chazal were aware of Hidden Persuaders. They were aware of it. They were aware that that a person is influenced by a lot of things, subjectives that he has no knowledge of even. He's not even cognizant, not conscious of it. Yet they're influencing him. So the only way he could counter that is with a counter emotion. That's the only way. He has to be able to put himself in a certain frame of mind. In order to avoid it, he has to counter it. That's basically what he says. He is a very poor Dayan, because he is incapable of real objectivity. That's what Chazal was saying. It has to do with individual perfection. But the situation in where this particular perfection is seen to the utmost is in a court of law. See? Of course, it has practical value also. If a person realizes this in everyday life, I'm sure it could be applied also. But essentially, it has to do with a person being a Dayan. Insofar as a person functions as a Dayan, it should be applied. Insofar as he functions as a Dayan. That applies it to situations in base matters too. See? Okay. What? The second member is a little more difficult. What does that do? Have you marba lachkar sa'edim? Have you zobed rechashem mitechem yobzim shul shaker? What is Shim ben Shetach's requirement over here? Have you zobed marba lachkar sa'edim? And also, have you zobed rechashem mitechem yobzim shul shaker? What is the nature of the activity?
Don't be
subjective. Principle altogether. It means one thing. What does it mean? It means that the dayan has to be capable of functioning in conflict. Functioning where he's in conflict. He's caught in a situation of conflict. On the one hand, one objective wants to do A, right? But objective A interferes with objective B. So he has to be able to function in conflict. You see? That's the memory of Shem Meshetach. Words. One way is insofar as he relates to the situation. So he might have to maneuver around, change the situation. But at least the activity is a unilateral type of activity. But over here, really, what he's caught up in is ambivalence. He's caught in, see, there's two reasons why a person can't, there's two things that hinder a person in terms of being able to achieve justice. One thing is the influential forces that are around him, you see, and he has to compensate for that. He has to use compensation. That's one thing. And the second thing is that he's drawn by two different things simultaneously, and it impedes his function. Simultaneously by two different things. He has two different objectives. So the two different objectives impede his function, prevent him from functioning. He has to be capable of functioning when he's in an ambivalent situation. See? That's the weakness of a human being. A human being has an easy time when he has to do one thing. Because basically the way an individual is constructed, he's constructed in a way that he could do one thing. As he has one mind, so he could set his mind to one goal. But when an individual has to jump from one, he has two goals and they're conflicting, so it impedes his function. It becomes very difficult for him to function.
Isn't a human being always back?
But since he only has one mechanism, so now he has to switch off from one side to another. He has to keep both goals in mind. Look at it this way, the opposite way. See? So the point is, the very nature of the mechanism of a person is such